that subject, all building up and substantiating and making his sensations credible, making the idea more real in his particular terms, right? So you can often be misled, like you look at artist's work and you think, oh, that's what he worked from. And maybe it's only one drawing of many, and we'll see that later. On the right, you get the total message of the nature of Van Gogh. One of his great problems as a human being was that he had difficulty in relating to other human beings. If I were my way, I'd make the readings of his letters compulsory for everybody, not just our students, to understand something of human nature, human predicament. His only real continuous contact was in his letters to his brother. He did make an attempt to set up, because of his tremendous isolation, he always had the dream of being part of an artistic society, the most gregarious artist, the type of person who drew people around him at that time was probably Gauguin. He admired Gauguin's work, and although he would be relatively unknown at that time, and he invited him to come to live with him, set up the beginning of artistic community, and of course a total failure. I won't waste time on that. What I'm trying to get to is that in his particular problems, he shows in this drawing this woman who worked for him, cleaned house, kept for him, things like that, one of the few people he had any relationship except from his doctor, Dr. Remy, and his dealer. He actually draws her, this old, beaten-up peasant scrubber, right? Totally unappealing, totally unattractive in physical terms. She might have been the salt of the earth, a miracle of human generosity, but what he describes her as, she's got a face like a beaten-up old potato, her knees are thick and almost broken with kneeling and scrubbing on earth floors and tile floors. At the same time, this is a very beautiful drawing because it's about his integrity towards this subject. No matter how he felt for her, and we have indications he had emotional feelings about her, there was no romanticism in it at all. There was no movement away from the search for the ultimate truth of his reality. He couldn't confuse the issue of his personal relationship to her. He had to deal with that new reality which he was experiencing and discovering. So there is, you should look at that from time to time, just as a jerk in your own integrity. It's very salutary. It's better than saying prayers, actually. Next, please. Here is another Van Gogh, again, which shows you the almost naive and simple way in which he develops the language that he needs. And so here, the different parts of the form have a different treatment. Okay, so you look at the face, and that is drawn with that almost stipple-like small mark, thousands of small marks. In Paris, you can go and see the materials he took out with him. You can see the five or seven pens. You can see the bottles containing the four different separate tones of ink, right? And all that kind of tremendous premeditation in preparation before setting out, and then sitting out there in the country day after day after day on one drawing, right? So anybody who believes the Hollywood myth that he's a kind of madman beating the hell out of the canvas, you know, in a purely expressionist gesture, the drawings have all happened before and while it's being done. And in that early stages, there was more drawing and rather less drawing, I should think, proportionally at the later stage. And here you can see the color of the red fez. Actually, when he did the painting, he got rid of the clutter of the bricks in the background because the geometry of them obtruded into the picture. This is only the top part of the full-length figure, which I've showed you already. The golden, two golden yellows, light and dark, warm, cool yellows, against the blue background and so on. So that's drawing. He's concerned with color, and so he draws color. And he's working out the image and the structure together. Here is a good example. I think I've ever showed you when we're dealing with color before. Again, you paint the way you draw. If you're drawing the color, building up the structure by the strokes of color, and that's the way you draw. This is a portrait by Van Gogh, a later one. And of course, it completely breaks away from the classical canons, which would see the head is absolutely symmetrical, and he distorts it. In actual practice, academically, if you have the axis of the head defining the tilt of the head over like that, then the line of the eyebrows, the nostrils, and the mouth would be at right angles. But here, he doesn't do that because he's more sensitive and more intelligent because he's working with the reality of what's involved. And he gives a much better sense of the tilt over the head, that sympathetic lean over to the arm, which is much better than the academic solution. It kind of slides over in a gentle relationship. And you can see how the rhythms and the structure are varied. They don't become mannered abstraction. The kind of forms and marks that you get in the eyes and nose are different to what you get in the stubbiness of the hands. You know, it's very particular in terms of this personal language which he's developed. If you look at the personal language of Cézanne, in this particular drawing, it really has its hereditary, pretty much an Italianate attitude, close to Rembrandt in many ways. He's drawing on the nearest part of the object, the nose. So he draws on the position of the nose, then up to the eye, out to the eye, then to the side of the face. He never gets to the point where he puts a mark around the beard. It doesn't really matter what shape you put round a jaw. It won't make the person look more or less like what they look like. Okay? So if I have a beard, if I have no beard, or have a part of a beard like I have now, or a long beard, I still look like Tom Hudson. Right? Doesn't matter what that shape is. And Matisse actually did a page of little drawings, four drawings of himself, with a different outline to the jaw. And it's irrelevant because the image comes from the structural sense of the total thing, and particularly the fixated positions of bone structure in relationship to features like eye, the mobility of nose and mouth, and so on. But if you see that, it's almost hacked out, it's almost carved, it's drawn and redrawn and reiterated, and the wonderful dynamic of curve and straight in the geometry of those eyes is really quite fascinating. You could compare that with a drawing, self-portrait drawing of Leonardo, and you'll see the difference, but you'll see a similar kind of intensity of perception. Leonardo is much more elegant. Cézanne was never elegant in the classical sense. He had a new kind of elegance, a new kind of structure, transcending what was the old reality, another person taking us a step forward. And here are two of his watercolor drawings. And you can see there that, he's defining and redefining outside, inside. So that you can't really put your finger on and say exactly where the edge of it's obviously green, it's some kind of melon, okay? But you can't really pin down where the edge of it is. But you have a sensation for the volume. Cézanne and most of the modern artists are more concerned with sensation than illusion. So in this particular piece of one of the multitude of drawings and wash drawings and paintings he did at Mont Saint-Victoire, you'll see that there's very little attempt at kind of linear perspective. There are slight indications, but the indications are mainly about the position and of plain edges, right? And you can see on the internal working on the clips on the side that he's concerned. The heaviest mark on the whole of that is the nearest part of that structure to the observer, those darker marks up there. In the foreground, you have that kind of frieze of rhythms across the front from the plant. What Cézanne did was to develop the notion of the concave, convex, and things like that into true geometric equivalents, thereby preparing the ground for Picasso and Cubism. So if you have you can do Mont Saint-Victoire. Okay, maybe it's Mont Saint-Victoire, okay? So you can do All right, you can do another one. And so on. You can keep on doing geometric equivalence, which can be authentically equivalence of that experience, according to the position, the time of the day. But even in the same position, you can create different dynamic equivalence for what is operating best within the context of the subject and the image that you're creating. And I use that term advisedly, geometric equivalence, because artists do not, really creative artists, never copy anything. They create equivalents for those complex sensations, not just of the eye and that kind of mindless copying, which still seems, it's so incredibly a part of Vancouver. You know, I find that this obsession about the photographic image and tiresome skill, diminished camera eye attitudes, I find it almost stronger here because of the isolation we suffer from. I find it here, and I find it in the drawings from schools. I find it among students. So art is not as simplistic and so limited and so naive and so bloody banal as that, right? What it does expect you to do now, you've taken away the absolutes. You still will learn how to use linear perspective and things like that because they're useful for some purposes. But the onus is on you now, with the autonomy of language and structure, for you to evolve your own systems. Some of the factors will be common to what you do. You might find there are some aspects of historical things which are useful for you, not necessarily European, but of Oriental. You might find some aspects of that are useful for what you're doing, right? Or you might find you want to do everything flat, right? And so on. Or you might find that you need complexes and mixtures of language within one image. And all of those things are possible, providing a person of integrity who is not just doing it stylistically and just gilding the lily and making things more and more complex, just to show how clever you are. Okay, so those are very important factors that you have to develop your own language. It will, if you're a creative person, be forced on you. You won't have to take yourself to account, because if you have young Picasso at the age of 10, between the age of 10 and 11, he can draw like an old master. When he went later in his life, was invited by the students at the Sorbonne to look at some of their work, he went round and thought it was all bloody awful. He said, "Oh, my God," he said, "I could draw like Raphael at the age of 10. You know? So if you can draw like Raphael at the age of 10, you're not going to bother to want to draw like Raphael all your life, right? So I mean that if you go to Barcelona, you can go to the new Picasso Museum there, and you can see three rooms of his work that he did as a young person, as a child. And even the life drawings are imbued with a certain vitality, which is uncommon. But that is very much, in fact, post-Raphael. It's a combination of Italian and French Ingres-type drawing. Drawing on the contour edge, you see moving in and moving out. That's subtly moving down the back, you can see, going flat, curved, concave, and then the side of the hip, the top of the thigh, bulges out, comes in front of the line of the back, all those abstractions of linear structure. And the accentuation of tone on the near parts of the form, the near leg, not only for it to come forward, but to give a sense of the tension on the back of the leg and where the elbow fits into the top of the knee, the boniness of the patella, and so on. This is Picasso, not when he's young, but round about the late part of the second decade, after he's gone through Cubism. He would still draw like this, like the student, beginning again. You know, to sit there and with ultimate patience do those three drawings. In spite of his vast reservoir of knowledge and his ultimate sophistication, and like taking the whole of mankind forward an incredible step with the invention of Cubism. But he said, "I invented Cubism for my own particular purposes." He wanted people to understand he was not giving them the new substitute, the new form of linear perspective, right? And what he's saying to you, "I invited my Cubism for my particular purposes. You invent your Cubism." Well, not really Cubism, but you invent your own method. We're no longer in a situation of hierarchies that I talked about before. We're now in the truly democratic situation requiring enormous responsibility the increasing complexity of the world, the tremendous problems of humankind can only be solved by the integrity of the individual making the most incredible demands. And that's what really what democracy is. And so we don't think of Picasso being a political person, but he is in fact telling us about this necessity that each individual has to achieve a level not only of achievement and a responsibility, but the demand of personal integrity. Personal integrity is sliding away in the new inhumanity of modern society. You see and hear of it all the time, every day, the gruesome inhumanity, the gruesome corruption, and all of that crap. So that maybe art schools, maybe the creative processes could be little islands of sanity in increasingly vulgar and corrupt worlds. It's up to you to decide whether you're going to be corrupted by art, right, the stylistic negative factors of artistic thievery, or whether you're going to develop your own processes relative to your own needs and conscience. But there you are. I just imagine them sitting down and looking at that bunch of grapes on the paper and the loving concern of defining each one with the ultimate integrity, not having a way of drawing one grape and repeating that for each one, but the personal self-discovery going on. Here you have a page from one of his notebooks where he's working on ideas. You have ideas, drawings at the level of non-qualitative drawings. That's the scribble and sketch on the back of an own envelope where marks mean something completely different to what they appear to be. And then you have qualitative drawings where you're doing drawings like towards a solution of a ceramic painting, sculpture, or what, where you have to qualify the form. You're evolving and discovering and inventing. And here is a little play of inventions, variations on the theme. On the cubist drawings, then none of them really become mechanical. They go through an academic. They go through tremendous changes. What would take 100 years, you know, 400 years ago, would take 100 years to evolve what Picasso himself evolved between the years of 1907, say, to about 1915 or 1916. Six major changes of development in structure and method and appearance of images. Diminished color, warm and cool grays, and then to arrive back to full color again. The more analytical, the more pattern structured, more decorative developments. And there'll be all kinds of mixes. So in this head here on the side, you'll find among the abstractions, you'll get other organic hints. And of course, the ears appearing on the side almost anatomically. So that's a kind of, again, that kind of response to the circumstances of what's happening on the paper reflecting in his mind. Just that little jokey inquiry and jokey representation. And of course, I was saying that things were changing and the aids to man were developing all the time. This is the work of Marie, but you had other people who were involved in researching the dynamics and movement. And of course, all the artists were aware of this kind of thing. But it was really a combination of features which made developments of cubism possible. This stems straight from the combination of the aspects of Cézanne's structural sense. And the planal development here, it becomes more autonomous. So that he's looking very much at the maximum features of turn of the form. The top of that nearest eyebrow, that's the point of maximum movement. On the structure of the head, when the head's static. You know, the frontal plane, side plane, going up the top plane. So that then the planes are indicated, but between the planes, he sets up other sequences and rhythms. And so when he came to his structures, three-dimensional things, there was a lot of space between plane edges. I often think that you can actually make sculpture just by reading the drawings, interpreting the drawings and the paintings of Picasso. Sometimes he did it with his own works, but a lot of other developments. A man can't do everything. So that sometimes you think, wouldn't it be wonderful if he'd spent more time doing sculpture? And when you look at the painting, you think, wouldn't it be better if he'd spent more time painting? But he could move from one development to another, and he could develop his drawings in flexible systems so that he was drawing according to need as well as for invention and exploration. This is a very, very key period, very key drawing, because if you look at this image of the glass, you'll see in this one he's still thinking of it as the self-contained object. Instead of it being circular, he's actually picked out the point and made an abstraction of the point of movement. So you get the intersection of those lines up at the top. That's equivalent to what I've just pointed out in terms of the human head, right? So here he's making planes operate, line and plane, the language which he's working with. Then he goes from that and he starts doing a number of different things which relate to different aspects, a combination of different points of view aspects, but also a psychological response. So he gives you, looking down on the plan, he gives you a section through, he gives you a tilted section, and so on. But he's still looking upon it as an object, a self-contained object. The really important factor was in the new type of space which was to be developed instead of the illusion. And that is where he's drawing the object, right? He draws the circle, you draw something outside the circle. He'll draw a section through, he'll draw the side of the table. So he's integrating object and other aspects of the environmental subject simultaneously, right? And that is very important. And this kind of opportunity he had to manipulate his own systems according to need meant an end to seeing from one point of view. I'm sure that when he started, he said, it's going to be so complex, this idea, I'm just going to start with an object, a simple object. And I'm sure he started with it, looking at it from a fixed point of view. Then I think he turned the object round. Then I think he took it into his hand, right? And he felt it, the sensations of it, right? And he turned it round. When you're drawing something with a thing in your hand, it's completely different to the traditional way of drawing it seen from a distance. But you can get to the point where you draw the thing. You don't actually need to hold it in your hand and move around to multiple points of view, because you know it enough that you can actually just be concerned about the selectivity. You can empathize. You can see in your mind's eye what it looks like from the other side, or feel what it's like on the outside, or feel intellectually what it is inside, and you can bring images of those sensations together into a new synthesis, a new image. If you research an object, you get so much information, you could put it into one image. So you have to sacrifice a great deal. So if I give each of you one object, the same object to research, right, you might all ultimately come up with all of the information. But if I say, create an image from that, you will use different combinations of information and arrive at different images. And that's philosophically what you're involved in. You have to assume the responsibility of that difference. People are always talking about, you know, the image of themselves and different. There's so much bloody twaddle talk these days, pseudopsychology. It's all very simple insofar as you have the capacity. You are differentiated. You're similar structures but differentiated, and it's reflected in what you do. When I do something on a piece of paper on the board, I put something of myself into that, and that's what you're doing. And you're creating. That's what drawing, in fact, is. This is later than that, some years later. This is by Boccioni. South of Europe, you have in Italy, you have the rather different, you could say that Cubism almost the kind of sublimely, almost spiritual affair, though you wouldn't use that term if you're psychologically oriented, whereas the Italians were materialist, brash, bombastic. But they were excited by the superficial features of a new mechanistic dynamic world. You know, their heroic idea was getting into a Bugatti and charging down the road at like 40 miles an hour. Oh, the windscreen shaking, you know, everything just about falling apart. I remember way back in 1928 when I was six with my uncle in this open tourer going over the border country and on a straight military road, and with my cousins, we're egging up my uncle on to drive the car at 60 miles an hour, which very, very few people did. But this was a very powerful tourer, and we actually had the car traveling at needle working around over 60 miles an hour. I think I knew then the excitement of a futurist, you know, of this, suddenly coming out of the bohemian garrets and their isolation and realizing belatedly, poor romantic buggers that they were, that the Industrial Revolution has been going on for 200 years and they've just woken up, right? So anyway, they did catch up with it in the end, and that is the dynamic equivalence of the static bottle but full of energy. The implications of modern science are beginning to penetrate. Einstein has already presented the first theory of relativity towards the end of the last decade. Rutherford at Cambridge has split the atom for the first time, and so suddenly everything's changed, and that's why the systems had to change. They could not deal with the new concepts of the modern world with the old systems, right? You cannot deal with this world, the atomic structure of this, right, and of this, all changing one every 136,000 part of a second, the whole structure invisibly but changing, right? That means that you can't really, no matter how much you admire Cezanne, you can't really paint them in his level of the world, and or further back the academic world, which is even more static. His is dynamic because it's transcending the reality. But the change in philosophy and of ideas and of new knowledge in that turn of the century was tremendously powerful and radical, and yet in a lot of education had just practically damn all influence at all. Unfortunate, but there we are. That's why the world's in such a mess, because people don't know what they're involved in. So here is one development of cubism in drawing and bringing in other material, bringing in the collage. Everything was possible now. It was a matter of the necessities and the integrity of the experience and the expression. And of course, the basic feature of this drawing is the same as the painting. The farthest part of that away from you is not some extensive illusion. The farthest part away from you is the paper on which it is drawn. So you think here of the dark marks coming and lying on the surface. As they get darker, there's a tendency to sensation forwards. There's a tendency for the original cubist frames. They were angling like that in to begin and extend the illusion into some vapid picture plane beyond. Okay? There's nothing more bloody ridiculous than see people doing what they think are modern works of art, post-cubist, and putting them in old-fashioned frames. It means they just know what the hell they're doing. Right? So what are we doing? A lot of modern works is you actually frame them flat, and you put kind of plastic all around, or just glass with no frame edges, or the paintings, you just put a strip around them, right? Just to enclose the image, to stop it floating vapidly away against the sensation of space of the wall behind. Quite different of that system and language is this drawing by Matisse. And of course, there we see the ultimate in elegance, and also the ultimate in the means of demonstrating structure in that tremendously fluid kind of line. But in actual fact, you don't see the many other drawings which would be done before this happens. That's why he said he had problems when he taught. He gave up teaching as quickly as he could. He had to teach because he couldn't get the money, you know. So as soon as he got the money, as soon as Shukin and the Russians started buying his pictures, he stopped teaching, and they said, "Why do you stop teaching? You're a wonderful, brilliant teacher." He said, "I can't stand the students. They just want a repetition. They just want a way to do it. You know, they're not really interested in being creative." And so he jacked out of teaching. And he said they want to be able to do it too quickly. You know, they misunderstand everything I say and do. So if you look at this, a person would do that and think, "Oh, I can do that." You can't do that. What you could do is look at the figure and understand basically what you'll respond to. It might be that the line of the figure can be expressed by a very rapid line, okay? Or you might have the tilt of the figure can be expressed in a few lines. But this is more than that, because it tells you tremendously about exactly where the artist is sitting relative to that model. It tells you about the youth and age of the model, the lift on the breast. It shows you the line of the cage of the ribs and how that is plunging in, plugged in to the width of the hips, which flow out. If you look at if you imagine the plane across the top of the chest, that is at a precisely different angle to the plane across the front of the hips. You know, everything is structurally absolutely under control. But this magic drawing, almost ethereally magic drawing. But behind that, there's a tremendous amount of struggle and search. This is a drawing, this reclining figure. And again, you can see how it is not just kind of photographic representation or drawing towards that kind of representation. Again, there are powerful structural things. The figure is leaning back, and you get the weight falling down at the breast. Get the head. The eye has been increased in scale. She's got nostrils like a horse. These are accentuated features so that you know exactly what the proper position is and the tension across the body. You can again see how the waistline there, the top of the torso, is plugged in, and you feel the great fullness of the hips and the buttocks, right? And the other part is plugged in. When he was teaching, he would say, make sure that you have the ear well screwed into the head. And don't forget that the foot is always involves a bridge, right? And he made analogies. He taught, don't forget, when you're looking at that model, that little part on the muscle there, that has the smoothness of an olive. And that model, with his musculature showing, he looks as if he's got the bones on the outside. He's like a lobster. You see the kind of convolution of the muscles on the frontal part of the body and the pectoral part of the chest. So there was always this incredible sense of structure. But people tend not to be able to read it. I mean, you get a wonderful sense of the tension on the bottom of the back, but you look from the breast and you get the hump of the curve of the cage of the ribs, and then you get this marvelous, fluid, relaxed line of the belly. Totally flaccid and inert, no tension on it whatsoever. And there you can see him doing the drawings, the studies for the mural, which he did, based on the dance series. And here you have some of his absolutely straightforward drawings. This is preliminary drawings towards the design and development of the chapel at Vons. He designed the architecture, all the objects and everything. So that it's two different drawings. He's looking at it on the right there. That's completely flat and schematic. And here he's drawing it with a kind of abstraction of volumetric, but no modeling, no shading, just the kind of overlap and position of things. A similar kind of early drawing, this is of Mondrian. You know what Mondrian's paintings look like, so when you see that, you can see the early drawings. And again, very similar to Matisse and Cezanne, the structuralists. No matter what the ultimate style and the final statements are, they have this tremendous structural sense of drawing. I mean, it could have been done by Cezanne in a way. And then you have the later drawing. This is a drawing in a later stage, the painting stage, and you don't see anything like that in the final works. What you see are the raised blacks or the flattened blacks. You get the difference of whites and grays and the balance of the three primaries. But here you can see the process of working. He doesn't tape it up and have it all finished like some art student thinks. It's a long struggle, a process of trial and error. From the first line that goes down, you put the first vertical line down. When you put the horizontal line down, the first line is going to be moved. Right? Everything is in a state of flux, and it's towards a new kind of asymmetry. The dominance of symmetry was a preponderant factor in structure and organization in the Renaissance for 400-500 years. And with the development of this century, we get many other different systems. But the dominant developments in the progression of growth and change was in the asymmetries of people like Mondrian. Another great person involved in development, this is from his book published, this is Kandinsky, from one of his studies. The Bauhaus was set up to be the first of the modern academies, and it was tremendously important development. Not that it had much influence in most countries, but there is just dealing with the language of abstraction. For the first time, a teacher was saying, well, if we're going to live in the modern world, And then we must deal with it in terms of modern philosophy. So people like Clay and Mondrian became the great teachers because they were making equivalents in education for what the new philosophies involved. A bit earlier than Kandinsky, Kandinsky was Russian, of course, but in 1913, a group in Russia called the Suprematists, they began to carry out research into the nature and processes of art. They said, what is art? What the hell is it anyway? What are the languages? And so they worked out study drawings, making a black square, then putting a black square beside a black square, then overlapping two black squares, and so on. What they were dealing with is a kind of practical psychology of perception, you know, to work out what are the fundamental elements. And they published their work and their fundamental suprematist elements. And fascinating. And later on, Kandinsky, they took part in the Russian Revolution. They took over the art colleges. One time, young Kandinsky, in his middle 20s, I think he was at the time, he became the inspector of all the Bucheviks, all the art schools in the whole of Russia. But, of course, by the time the Stalinists took over, he left. He had the choice of staying and conforming or leaving, and he left and he went to Germany. This was one of the first books which dealt with the implications of the new kind of objectivity. You make a line and you understand what the implications of rhythm are. You deal with the whole research of lines of a particular kind, straight, curved, and so on, flexible, fluid, free, all these, doing one and then making a counterpoise, like bringing two chords together in a piece of music, part of a fugue. And this is Leisure. This is, again, a very personal language. And you can see that it's very systematized. It deals with volume, but it keeps them fairly shallow. It's almost drawn like a relief, okay? It's a very conventionalized system, but it works well for his particular kind of painting. There you have a slightly wilder piece by Miro, drawn in a very, very fluent way, very fluid. And again, referential parts to particular parts of anatomy, person, people. I often think that that must be a portrait of Stravinsky up at the top left. Not that he would want to bite the hand that fed him, whatever it's supposed to be. But the reason I brought that in is because once you open the gates, the floodgates of opportunity, there'll be some kind of idiotic things done, and there'll be some very, very important things done. But things have to be tried. Things have to be tested. And you can see the introduction of that hank of rope with all the implications and significance symbolically. Here are two different aspects of space. Here is the kind of, this is matter, working with the development of abstract language, and he manipulates chromatic space to accommodate these slightly surreal, slightly kind of science fiction kind of developments. That is kind of carrying the tradition of space from Renaissance concepts of space, but more open, everything interpenetrated. This is Giacometti the sculptor, and yet he seems to draw in a very linear way, more like a painter. I know that all sculptors drew like painters right through the Renaissance because all the developments, all the inventions tended to be predominantly visually from the painters, and so that the poor sculptors were held in thrall by the painters. But in this century, it works the other way. So that many sculptors, for example, will draw flat because they read them three-dimensionally. And here... Is it? Okay. I've got a rat race through this now. There's the transparent world of Paul Klee, another personal language. Here is Nalder returning to a kind of variation of Rembrandt's brush painting. Here we have a drawing by Miro on a piece of animal skin, and there's the use of natural materials and prints of them in by de Buffet, sort of partly frottage, partly cut out and spraying, but he also actually made objects which relate to that. I mean, he made works with banana skins in them, and ashes and earth and various other things. This is another one of his kind of very psychological, kind of orientated. It's always about the predicament of man. Here, the three figures you can see there, caught up in the interior. And that is an American artist who was born Russian, Ashiel Gorky, and who has obviously learned a great deal from Picasso and from Miro particularly. But he had a profound influence as a teacher. and a model for the young American abstract expressionist. He's moving towards the kind of gesture. Very similar to Mura, to Miro. Very, very beautiful linear elegance. And then the kind of sometimes quite drastic brush strokes, gestures afterwards. This is a sketchbook from Pollock. You can see he's got his shopping list down the top side there. There's bits of his laundry list in as well. It's all part of operating on the sheet. You know, everything is grist to the mill, and that's one of his drawings, which is particularly diverse and varied. A lot of logic and kind of manipulation in it, not like many of the paintings, which divest themselves of that kind of overt manipulation. And here is Klein on the left, paintings, but they look wonderful as drawings anyway. And of course, they are part of the expressionist philosophy of, I want nothing to come between myself and the image. One of them said that would stand for them all. So it's drawing it from the unconscious as well as the conscious. But you have to get the things in the right order. Right, the conscious, the logical decide how much paper you're going to use, how big is a sheet of paper, how many sheets of paper you're going to be working on, serially or simultaneously or piecemeal, right? And then how are you going to be deterministic about what you're going to keep and what you're going to destroy, what's important, what's not important, right? And what are the sources of development going to be, what can they be? That's all the logic, which is balanced by the intuitive power of the body and the mind in action. The simultaneity of thought and action is what Pollock, that's the new man. If the new man was a colorist like Van Gogh at the end of last century, then Pollock was the new man in terms of this new relationship of body-mind. It's very easy to make unconscious marks quickly. It's very difficult to make unconscious marks slowly. But that's another problem. Motherwell on the right, Elegy to the Spanish Civil War. Just run through these. Two prints which I have at home. This is 0 to 9, and that is the development on the flag. And that is by Jasper Johns, of course, one of the great draftsmen of the century. His wonderful gray piece, alphabet grays on the right, and wonderful combinations. You'll know that, I expect you've seen the one on the left, variant of that in terms of the three primaries. And then a very, very careful drawing of a very boring subject, like a piece of string, one would think, and then transform into one of the new images in that kind of response again to the immediate phenomenal world. Then a play on art and process. Again, this is Lichtenstein. He likes fun and games. Rauschenberg and Oldenburg on the left. Drawing, this is a series of illustrations really to the cantos of Dante. And then on the right, that's the study for a kind of gigantic piece of sculpture for somewhere in Toronto, a kind of anti-gravity sculpture. And here you have the same artist working on symbols, symbolism. You can see the relationship to a popsicle and Mickey Mouse and the lipstick, all interrelated forms, which is all research, you know, to the film camera, to the gun, right? You must have if you're going to be dealing with language, you must have some words, right? Phrases. And then on the right is going to the actual world of signs and symbols. Those are all current symbols used in different developments of human activity. One of the great topological diagrams of all time is the underground map of London. That's British designers dealing with the ergonomics of the interior of a car. That's the kind of presentation drawing. So there's two drawings of the designer. One, the information, the utilitarian, the functional diagrams. On the other, the lying, often lying and specious presentation drawings, which are to fool the customer. And some trademarks and traffic signs, and the logos, which have developed out of that, and the house styles, which come from that, the use of maps and different traditional systems of diagram making, a play, often with fun and games, wonderfully exciting things to do. And this is, again, using the analytical thing. Two things are important. One is the multiple points of view, freedom from the fixed point of view. The other thing is the analytical method. of dealing with the world of knowing, whether you can see or not, negotiating the interior. And of course, that is for a graphic design production, the digestive system of the hand, the beautifully designed elegance of the interior of the egg. And then look over there as the kind of thing which I find a little interesting, but it's necessary. That's an example of the most extreme form of representation for medical scientific purposes. I don't think it's very good, actually. I think it's too complex. And here you have other types of diagrams. Using a schematic system like that in the form of development of isometric projection. On the right, the various diagrams, that's for a Swiss or German pharmaceutical firm. And here, I'm just going to go quickly through what we do, like as students, in terms of exploring the physical mark, exploring the mark in relationship to subject, exploring the physical mark in relationship to media, scale, and space, exploring imagery of an intuitive kind and recognition, and some more of those. And then one shot of a student doing her image research variations on the theme, growing, development, and exploration, so that she would probably turn out about all of those drawings in the course of about 2 or 3 hours. Okay? Developing by that time a certain amount of fluency after drawing for a few weeks every day. Some more by the same person. There's another person working in a slightly different way, but working serially on a number simultaneously. And this is analysis for, again, that exploration, not a physical mark. The mark's ruled out. It's about image. The possible implications of a square, of a circle, and a fast logical, slow logical and fast developments combined mixture of systems. Exploration, this is from a small pool of water and dirt. That's distortion, creating a different level of abstraction on a tube. Looking at objects, looking at the objects from a fixed point of view, but changing the imagery on the right, separate drawing for each characteristic, the linear interpretation, the shape interpretation, the texture interpretation, and so on. And again, more research, looking at different things. And here, too, looking at a piece of fruit, working with color. There was only 2 of about 8 drawings of studies of that piece of fruit. And this is interesting by a Singhalese girl. That's a drawing she did without any preliminary study, because out of her tradition, coming from Colombo in Sri Lanka, she had a ready-made ethnic system before she came to be a student with me. And she looked at, sitting in front of her, she had this sliced through melon. And I mean, I couldn't read it like that. I mean, I had to draw it, and I had to look at that for quite a while before I could come to a sympathetic empathy and interpretation like she had. That is a study of a brush, a 2-inch paintbrush, its implications. And that is study of a mixer. This is where I was giving them problems like of how things work, okay? How you diagram. So drawing is for not only for art, it's for information, for designing. Something that happens in a moment in time, you know, like striking a match and the optical implications be done in black and white, and then what happened to the match, okay? Much more expressionist kind of response, introducing color and different structural interpretations. Here, translating the implications of an image from a newspaper. During the Vietnam War, we're all shocked, especially in English newspapers, when they never show anything violent, or didn't. And we saw this South Vietnamese officer blowing the brains out of this captured Viet Cong. And so that student did about 20-odd different interpretations, trying to understand the implications, significance, and meaning and extensions of that one photographic image. There's another analytical thing of how the zip fastener works, but using nails and dog tags and things like that, okay? Because you can feel free to do that, not just in a kind of silly collaging way, in a decorative way, but as a constructive necessity. And here we have this. I had a master class of, I think I was 9, and we're in Glasgow in Scotland, and they'd never been there at all, so we started making a map, which was based, a diagram based on their experience, It was about 40 feet long, and each day they added to that diagram. And here we have processes, how things happen in time, enameling, use of a potter's wheel. This is about an apartheid demonstration. People came back and everybody disagreed about what had happened because everybody was encased in their own experience. So we got a collective diagram done. That was about metamorphosis. This is about emotional experience. This is about what happens to you in sort of 24 hours emotionally. There's a complex code. That is a sketch study working out emotional changes over a period of a certain number of hours and defining a particular code. We wanted to explore that because normally we're dealing with objective things. So I said, why don't we, well, people always talk about objective, why don't we do subjective drawing? Right? So that was an interesting thing. Then some objective ones now. Very elegant piece of drawing by Nervi, the great Italian engineer architect. That's the student's work. This is very different kinds of marks. That's drawings from a student who made machine sculpture. And that's one of his drawings where he combines a very fluid form with which he wouldn't make materially with the controlled, elegant developments. This is exploring the objects, the world of objects, in a kind of neo-cubist way. That combination of handmade marks and photography. About foundation students. I showed you that before, didn't I, when I showed you color, that kind of drawing. And there we are. Okay? Thank you very much. Don't forget to sign the sheet. I've got to stop there. There's another half lot to go through, but the class will get them. Our evening class will get them. Don't forget to sign.